I'm Ilan Stavans, host of In Contrast, a new podcast from New England Public Radio. It's a dialogue about culture in the making. Our guests come from all walks of life. They are magicians in the way they articulate ideas, ideas that are distinct and often innovative. We'll talk with people that are passionate about theater, activism, translation, literature, politics, and the arts. You will find them quirky, restless, engaged, and insightful. So join me every 2 weeks for In Contrast. Next, episode 1, Where the Words Come From.
So there's two parts of our definitions, of all definitions. The first part is the lexical fact. What does the word mean? How's it spelled? The second is the usage or cultural fact.
What is the role of dictionaries? Do we still need them? Who puts dictionaries together? I'm Ilan Stavans, and this is the In Contrast podcast from New England Public Radio. We're talking about words and dictionaries. My guest is Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster, a publisher of dictionaries since 1831. Peter Sokolowski is the author of many definitions for Merriam-Webster dictionaries. He is an active blogger, podcaster, and speaker on language. He has served as a pronouncer for spelling bees worldwide and was named amongst Time Magazine's 140 best Twitter feeds of 2013. Peter, it's wonderful to have you around.
It's great to be with you, Ilan.
I want to ask you how the words come to be.
How do words come to be? Words, as you know, you're a philosopher of language. Words are abstract. They're just labels. They're just sounds, a collection of sounds that convey a meaning. And so when a large group of people agree that one group of sounds means the same thing, that becomes a word. And other things like spelling and grammar, those come later. And as we know in English, particularly one of the jobs of the dictionary is to kind of keep track of spelling. Spelling is particularly difficult in English because of its history of borrowing words from many different places. And of course, the phonetics have changed, which is why our spelling no longer reflects the sound of the language, which is why English is particularly tricky. But that also emphasizes the sort of abstraction of language, doesn't it? If a word like knight in shining armor is spelled in this odd way, what is it carrying? Why do those letters, extra letters, remain? And it's carrying its own weight of its own history. And I sometimes think of that history, the etymology, as the word's biography. And so a word will tell its own story if you go back in time.
Who are the people that end up making dictionaries? Do you think that they have a particular passion early on in life? Are they trained? Is there a school that one goes to in order to become a lexicographer?
That's a good question. First of all, there is, to my knowledge, no program, not even a course in lexicography. There is some good instruction in English departments and in linguistics departments that address historical linguistics, sociolinguistics, and lexicography. And I just lectured recently at Rutgers with a great professor, Jack Lynch, who does that and who looks at the history of not just the language, but the way the language is recorded. And that's an extra layer and an interesting layer. But no, there are no degrees, there are no diplomas or programs in lexicography. So at Merriam-Webster, the idea is that diversity of background is perhaps more important. If we assume that all the people who want to work on dictionaries love language, that's the sort of premise, then it's actually good to have people who are from different backgrounds, you know, physicists, people who do math, people who do art history, music history, other languages. My specialty was modern French and early modern French. There are lots of course, etymologists who look at the history of the English language going down through the years. And so what had been done at my time and for decades was that a seminar was held once you were hired. So you already got the job. And then this wonderful man with the best title in publishing, Director of Defining, who for many, many years, the first director of defining was E. Ward Gilman, and he has been succeeded by Stephen Perrault. And that position is one of not just sort of wisdom and experience, but also specific style information. How do we identify an attributive noun? Mm-hmm. You know, how does Merriam-Webster divide senses? What is meant by the division between what we call the lexical and the encyclopedic? You know, there are all these very technical questions that have to be answered and also have to be introduced because they're so abstract. Little corners of the language that you never thought existed. For example, most native speakers of English never think of what we call a count noun or a non-count noun. We don't have to worry about that. But when we worked on a dictionary for non-native speakers, we all had to learn that kind of grammar. So part of it is grammar, part of it is usage, part of it is style, and part of it is this sort of specific history to Merriam-Webster's traditions of dictionaries.
How did you come to be part of Merriam-Webster?
I just answered an ad. There are a few people who say they always wanted to do this. I know of some people who knew at age 8 that they were fascinated by dictionaries. I was fascinated by language. So most of us come from either linguistics or literature, so either the science or the art of language. I was a literature guy, and I went to France on exchange, and I loved reading the literature that I read. I specialized in Montaigne, but also worked on other 16th century writers. But I also loved the great neoclassicists in French and Proust, and I just sort of fell in love with French literature, and I wanted to be a French professor. So I taught French as a teaching assistant at the University of Massachusetts. And then there was an ad. I finished a master's degree, and I saw an ad in the paper looking for I remember it said translator/editor of French from Merriam-Webster. That's all I knew. There was no other explanation. And so I got the interview, and they said, we want to write a French dictionary. And I had, I think, a normal reaction, which is, don't you already have one? Don't you already have a dictionary? And that question, I realized, is actually the natural reaction from most people to the idea of this job, which is why do you have to keep working on it? I mean, doesn't the dictionary sort of exist as a platonic ideal, the dictionary? And that's the beginning of my real education, which is to learn how this process begins.
Peter, imagine for a second that no dictionaries existed, that in our culture there was no volume, no authority that would tell us how language works or doesn't work. Would we be freer? Would language still be contained? Do we need dictionaries, particularly at a time when, as a result of immigration, of globalism, one feels that the constant pressure on a language, say that English, because of its planetary presence, or smaller minor languages as well, ends up having a back and forth that pushes new words out, makes some words go out of fashion. Do we need the dictionaries?
That's a really good question. It's easy to imagine in the early modern period, for example, Shakespeare wrote with no dictionary. We know that he spelled the same word in many different ways sometimes. But spelling is probably the least of the problems in this case. There are manuals in the late Middle Ages, manuals in the early modern period, the 1500s, there are manuals teaching citizens of Great Britain how to speak French. And the idea was for the burgeoning or the emerging commercial class, if you spoke French, you'd have a higher caliber of customer because the ruling class spoke French. That is to say, after the Norman conquest. And so there were manuals of learning language for a very practical purpose, which leads us to ideas like trade languages and pidgins that are a kind of a common lingua franca for those who come in contact for a specific purpose. So the fact is, I think that we would all still understand each other, but the borders might be a little bit more fluid. Mm-hmm. And that we see, for example, in a place like Europe, where languages such as French and Italian and Spanish, which are all contiguous geographically, were at one time, of course, Latin. In effect, they're all bad Latin today, and they developed in their own directions, but they are in some ways mutually comprehensible, or at least mutually recognizable. And so those language families may have spread in that way more rather than the sort of political borders that we think of today. Dictionaries are kind of rule-bound by definition, if I can make that pun, and that tends to emphasize difference, doesn't it? But the fact is, at the same time, you have these bodies that work in opposite ways. For example, the French Academy and other national academies appear to resist that change in those borrowings. And English has no such academy. And I think that's an interesting idea, that the aesthetic of English is an explosion, is always creating new words and always adapting and adopting them. The aesthetic of Shakespeare is one of expansion. And yet in France, the cultural equivalent, say, Molière and Racine, their aesthetic was to use as few different words as possible to attain a kind of neoclassical perfection. And that just shows a very different national character, and it's reflected in the language.
You are listening to In Contrast from New England Public Radio. I'm Ilan Stavans. My guest is Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large of Merriam-Webster. Peter, do all languages have the same amount of words?
They sure don't. They sure don't. English has an enormous number, and we don't know, and that's the problem. It's very hard to assess. When we count words, do we count all the inflections? This is the primary question. So is run a simple word, or do we count run, running, ran, and runs? So that's one problem. Another problem is one of sort of cycle. I mean, if I counted from 1 to 1 million, that would be 1 million words. And yet, does that really represent our vocabulary? I do know that those languages that are strictly Latin-based, for example, French and Italian, they tend to have much reduced vocabulary. And English has this advantage of having gained the Latin vocabulary, mostly after the Norman conquest. And we gain this richness of subtlety because we have two words for everything. We have the Anglo-Saxon or the Old English word, and we have the Latin word or the French word. So a word like kingly is the equivalent to royal. We have both. We use them both. And they're never exactly synonymous. There is a reason for both. And often, as has been remarked, the Anglo-Saxon or the Old English word will be the one that is the more homey word, the more emotional word. And the Latin words tend to be the more distant ones intellectually. That's why our entire vocabulary for law and government and medicine are all in Latin. And so we have these registers and these layers of language that add to the total number. And English is an unusually large language for that reason.
And even with these challenges that you're describing, would you venture a number? Could you say that there are, I don't know, I'm guessing here, 2 million words in the English language, whereas French or Spanish or Swahili have a less number because of their imperial histories or because of the habitat in which they live?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you realize is that the history of a language is the cultural history of its people. And we used to say in correspondence, we get many letters at Merriam-Webster, roughly 1 million is a good call. But I don't see any reason to argue against 2 million either. It's just, it's really difficult to assess this. I mean, for one thing, there's many words that are spoken and are never written, and they become difficult to catalog. They're difficult to analyze. They're difficult to put in dictionaries.
Do you have any sense of what the average American has as her or his base vocabulary on any given time? And here I know you mentioned the difference between a spoken English and written English. But when we think of the average youngster, 17, 18-year-old, which I'm sure is going to be different from somebody who is 30 or 35, any sense of how many words, different types of words, would we need to communicate the way we do in the United States in 2017?
The number is, I think, astonishingly small for the base number of needed words. Our dictionary for learners, we call it the Learner's Dictionary. For non-native speakers, we restricted ourselves to a vocabulary of about 3,000 words to write the definitions for 100,000 words. And you know what? You can do that. You can actually break things down into their constituent parts and use basic vocabulary, not baby talk, but plain English. I think a lot of educated adults would have more like 20,000 words in their vocabulary. There may be something that I think of as a passive vocabulary for people who read a lot, for example, that they may recognize these words but not use them in conversation. And I think that's an interesting category too, because that would be hard to measure. But yeah, about 3,000 words that would only get you really to the third year of English, perhaps. But I can think of a word like vitriolic, which is obviously kind of a high-level vocabulary word, and its definition in our collegiate dictionary has also very difficult words in the definition. It says something felt to resemble vitriol, especially in caustic quality, especially virulence of feeling or of speech. It sounds like a dictionary definition. But that same word is defined in our learner's dictionary as harsh and angry words, and especially the two angry words. That really gets you almost all the way. And vitriol, the original meaning, was a liquid that burns, like hydrochloric acid. So from liquid that burns to words that burn, you get the figurative and the metaphorical senses. And that word harsh keeps the burn in the definition. So in other words, we're trying not to sacrifice accuracy, but increase the readability of the dictionary.
And how do you at Merriam-Webster and your team come to decide what a definition should be for a word? Do you feel that definition also needs to change over time, or are definitions static? What gives a dictionary its fluidity, its elasticity, and what makes it set? Because many of us users want to know that the dictionary is set, that when we're opening its pages or online, these words are here to stay, and that the definition that we are encountering today is going to be the same one that we encountered yesterday or tomorrow, though that is really difficult to comprehend.
Absolutely. I mean, you really have identified the crucial issue, because first of all, the paradox of lexicography is that we, as lexicographers, we celebrate novelty. You know, we bring the new words in, we define them, but we also essentially represent stability. Because if the language weren't stable, we wouldn't be able to have this conversation today. So there's this paradox that we're all playing with, and it cuts both ways. We can't always look for the novel without sacrificing some of the stability. The fact is, I think the job of the lexicographer, the job of a dictionary editor, is revision. The fact is, if you were to look at the definitions, not just of Noah Webster from 1828, but even from our own dictionaries from the 1930s, you would be shocked at the number of assumptions and prejudices and incomplete notions of how the culture is expressed in those definitions. And we are changing them. I just got a note that we changed some very important definitions today, because we don't necessarily publicize them, but we want to keep up. And basic things like sexism that are inherent in the culture and therefore inherent in the language become easier and easier to recognize over time. And therefore, it's essential for us to reduce that in the dictionary, to take them out of the dictionary. And a simple thing like using the pronoun he, as a sort of gender-neutral pronoun, that's an easy thing to avoid in writing. And so we've done that over a long number of years to sort of change the dictionary and the way the language is reflected according to the way the culture has evolved, and not present the prejudices of 80 or 100 years ago in today's dictionaries.
Do dictionaries tell people how to use language, or do people tell dictionaries how to think of language?
Well, the fact is, dictionaries reflect the usage and report on that usage like a good journalist does. And I think that's something that's not always well understood, because, again, this paradox of looking like an authority but reflecting the active changing language means that essentially we are a record of the changing language, which means we're always a step behind. We're looking at the language in the rearview mirror. We're a lag indicator of those changes. The fact is, this only constant of language is change, but there's a corollary to that, which is that language changes just fast enough that we notice. And there's another corollary, which is those changes that we notice, we almost always hate. So the words that seem to be novel today that we didn't grow up with or didn't go to school with are the ones that we object to. But of course, kids today arguments against language change have been made since Cicero. And anyone who makes a kids today argument against language was themselves once a kid. For example, the word finalize, completely uninteresting word. It was the most controversial word in our 1961 unabridged edition. We were criticized twice in the same week in the pages of the New York Times for adding finalize to the dictionary. And today, no one even notices that word. More recently, verbs like access and impact. Access was objected to quite a lot about 20 years ago. Now, of course, no one objects to it because of frequency. Mm. Frequency means we've encountered this word so often, we encounter it daily, many times a day maybe, and that means it's become accepted. Impact, however, that's a different case. Maybe some people of a certain age will stop, will draw the line there and say, you know, I won't use that word. So even though the dictionary might be viewed as a gatekeeper of a kind, it has to be recognized that to use the tool well, you have to understand that it is reflecting what is most frequently encountered. It doesn't mean that it's telling you that this is a intrinsically good or bad usage. So there's two parts of our definitions, of all definitions. The first part is the lexical fact. What does the word mean? How is it spelled? The second is the usage or cultural fact. Is it offensive? Is it vulgar? Will you be judged severely by it? And the fact is, we all have to step back and recognize that we are all judged by the way we use language.
Are you comfortable with that description of the language police? The fact that those that put together dictionaries, or those that are connected with the health and durability of language, are seen as authorities that others might want to run away from or embrace. And is it accurate to think that the younger you are, the more liberal you'll be in connection with language, but the older you get, you will become more conservative?
I think there is a natural tendency in that direction. But first of all, nobody wants to be a traffic cop of language. That's because, first of all, that's a fool's errand. It would be very difficult. And I promise failure to anyone who tries. So we don't try to be the traffic cop. We try to educate people to the extent that we can, that we are much more like collectors, you know, that we're out, or hunters of words. We're out there looking for the usages, looking for the evidence, and throwing it in one place that's easy to find. One thing I think is certain, and that we've learned over these last two decades with the internet becoming part of our business, and indeed the major part of our business, is that people don't want to write their own dictionaries. they do expect a certain professionalism and a kind of careful linguistic attention made for these words. And some of these words are very important to the culture. It could be a word like marriage. It could be a word like access. It doesn't have to be politically a hot-button word. But if someone has spent a lot of time and careful thought organizing that word's meanings, people do appreciate it. We now know, because of the data that our dictionary online gives us, the words that people look up the most are not the new words like twerk or blog, you know, the kind of the fleek, the new words that are kind of getting attention, but the abstract words, integrity, paradigm, conundrum, ubiquitous.
They search them because they want to understand what the concept is behind?
They're looking for nuance. I'm sure of it. You know, we're good at reading data. We're not good at reading minds. Another thing we get from our data is the immediate and temporary interest in a news story. So when the word deplorable was in the news, you better believe the word deplorable was being looked up in the dictionary. And that's true every day. We see different words from the news, and they may be utterances from newsmakers, they may be headlines from the papers, they may be related to sports victory, but they are words from popular culture that are looked up in the dictionary. But the evergreen words, the ones that are there day in and day out, regardless of the news, those are the ones that lexicographers work the hardest on. That's our bread and butter. And again, a word like integrity, that's an abstract concept. A lot of people think they know what that means, but once in a while, they clearly ask themselves, where are the margins? Where are the boundaries of this word? There are other reasons too, like pronunciation, obviously, that, you know, mechanical things, spelling, for people to look up words. A basic example of this is affect and effect. These two words that are cruelly difficult to use in English and are spelled similarly and pronounced similarly, those are two of the most looked up words in the dictionary, which is gratifying to a lexicographer because you realize the trouble here is English and it's not cultural. It's specific to the language.
You are listening to In Contrast from New England Public Radio. I am Ilan Stavans, and my guest is Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large at Merriam-Webster. The two summits of English language lexicography are Merriam-Webster and the Oxford English Dictionary. One is in England, the other one is in the United States. One is connected with a veteran university. The other one is a commercial enterprise, almost from the very beginning. Can you talk about the contrasts between them?
Well, I love the two traditions, and I think it's important. I have to sometimes tell people that some of my best friends are editors at the OED, that we don't have an adversarial relationship. They're not my enemies. And in fact, a couple of wonderful books have just come out about the making of the OED, and I highly recommend them. I think that we have to start with the big picture, which is that the two dictionaries serve two different purposes. The Oxford English Dictionary is a historical dictionary of the English language, and it is a monument to the humanities. It is one of the great achievements in the humanities, and it is what I would call a diachronic dictionary across time. It measures 1,000 years of English. The Merriam-Webster tradition has always been a synchronic dictionary, like synchronicity or synchronous, a single moment in time. So the Merriam-Webster tradition is to present a single volume dictionary that measures the current active vocabulary of American English. And so that's a narrower mission. However, our jobs, the work that we do, the research that we do, in many ways is very similar. The research into the history of a word and into its usage and looking in electronic corpora, databases of words, to find out how those words are used. And also, the two traditions are the two great traditions of paper citations. You know, we have about 15 or 16 million of them in our office here in Springfield, and the Oxford English Dictionary has many paper citations too, because the history of lexicography is all written on tiny slips of paper, which is the way Johnson did it and Webster did it and everybody else. So we started from paper, we've moved to the digital. Our processes and methods are similar, but the expression of that research is different. And the big difference, the real difference, is that the Oxford English Dictionary presents all of those quotations, all of that literature in sentences in the dictionary. So you can see, this is how Shakespeare used the word. This is how Milton used the word. This is how Spencer used the word. With Merriam-Webster, we focus much more on the definitions.
The passing from the Obama years to the Trump years is about many things, including the change between approaches to the English language by both leaders. And I wonder if there are other ways of understanding the use of the English language by our leaders affects in any way, maybe the humor, maybe the general cultural landscape of who we are as a people.
Yes, I mean, we're not cultural critics, and we're certainly not political critics either. But one thing I can say is, as regards our data, we get 100 million page views a month, so that when a public figure uses language in a remarkable way, that is often a word that is consulted in the dictionary. It sends people to the dictionary. Now, that could be a word that is political. I remember the word demagogue was used during the Republican primaries by Republicans referring to Donald Trump. And that was a word that was looked up very frequently at the time. And I have to just remind everybody that the data that we have is neither an accusation nor a diagnosis, and that curiosity is not ignorance, and that looking up these words by no means is any kind of an accusation to an individual or a group of people. And I am pleased to report that the curiosity of the public doesn't surprise me that much, because we see it year in and year out. We see it about whatever story is at the top of the news. It just so happens that right now politics has been the top of the news and for the past year or so. And that's true for every news media outlet too. We're not a news media outlet, but what's interesting is we can view the news through the prism of vocabulary and tell a different story, because the words, you can never predict which words will be the ones that send people to the dictionary. So, for example, recently we had vindicated that President Trump used and ignominious that Jake Tapper used were two of the most looked up words last week. And, well, they're both kind of vocabulary words. They both happen to have Latin roots. And we're thrilled that people turn to us for this reason at this time. And we try to respond to that by writing a little article maybe about the history of the word, maybe as it's used in politics or in whatever category it's found in, and report that as broadly as we can, which is on the internet.
You are also a devotee of jazz, yeah. And you play the trumpet, and you are a radio announcer. And I wonder if I can invite you to make a connection between how jazz is shaped, what jazz is, and how language is shaped in what language is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because they both require a structure. And what I mean by that is that there is a grammar to jazz. There's a grammar to music. I wrote some of the definitions on jazz music and some biographies for an encyclopedia project that were just a terrific treat for me to be able to do, but also allowed me to break down these ideas into their constituent parts. And for example, swing as music, we had a definition that was kind of old, kind of clunky, a little bit condescending. I didn't like it. It wasn't very accurate. So I rewrote the definition. I'm thrilled to say that it was put in right away. They changed it. If I read my definition of swing here, it says jazz that is played as by a big band with a steady beat and that uses the harmonic structures of popular songs and the blues as a basis for improvisations and arrangements. Now, it's not a lovable piece of writing. However, the harmonic structures of popular songs and the blues, that's the grammar of the music. Those are the rules by which you have to play. If you don't acknowledge that harmony, if you don't acknowledge the tempo and the beat and the intonation, then you're not really working within the tradition. You're not able to communicate with your other players in the way that they're accustomed. And so in that same way, you can be innovative in language, but you only break the rules when you know them. And that is exactly the same for innovations in music, which is to say, whether you're talking about Bach or Charlie Parker, talking about people who had mastered what came before them before they moved forward. And in that sense, language requires a mastery. And that mastery has to be spontaneous elements mixed with fixed forms, which could be grammatical, syntactical, or even idiomatic. That's precisely the same. A good jazz musician has to be fluent in the same way that a good speaker has to be.
In becoming a member of a group that is in charge of collecting words and shaping definitions and producing a dictionary, you have to give up your ego or maybe your individuality to some degree. One feature of a dictionary is that it doesn't have a name, an author, that in spite of the fact that we have Noah Webster as the great source of the Merriam-Webster, we don't have this definition being written by Peter Sokolowski and this other one by somebody else on the staff, but one gets the sense that there is a collectivity behind. Is it hard, both as a jazz player and as a dictionary maker in terms of definitions, to give up your individual features in order to become part of this current that will be the company's presentation of what language is about?
To a certain extent, in music, there are times when you have to melt in and blend with the ensemble, and the times when you step forward. And I'm glad you noticed that. That's an important point, that dictionary definitions are not signed. Our articles on language about these trends and others, they're not signed either. And I know the staff, we rotate, we write them, sometimes collaborate. I'm really glad that we don't sign those articles, because we are trying to the extent that we can to project the wisdom of a lot of experience and a lot of collective wisdom. That is to say, people working together in the now, but also the history that we can represent. I do think if you want to always have your own voice, then you probably wouldn't end up writing dictionary definitions because you would be inclined to write for yourself. Now, many lexicographers are also wonderful writers and write, you know, memoirs, poetry, and articles and fiction. So I think we kind of scratch that itch in a different place. But we have to recognize that you have to sort of sublimate your ego for the benefit of the dictionary. And the dictionary should read as if it were written by essentially one person.
Unlike other languages, other European languages, I'm thinking of French, you mentioned it, Spanish, Italian, that have an academy, say the Académie Française or la Real Academia Española or the Italians or even languages like Hebrew, English does not have an academy. And this has been a feature of the language from the very beginning. In the United States, as the country became independent, there was an attempt, even involving some members of some of the founding fathers, to create such an institution that would legislate, that would be in charge of safekeeping the English language. At a time like today, with the rise of very strong populist leaders, maybe the sense that people want a figure that will tell them how to act, because living in the modern times can be scary, can be disorienting, can be confusing. Should we revisit the idea? Would we benefit from having an academy devoted to studying, to safeguarding, to disseminating the knowledge of what the English language is in Washington, D.C., paid by your in my tax dollars?
I would be against an academy. I have two ideas about this. First of all, languages certainly do follow rules, but they don't follow orders. And that is observable and true. And so we have linguists, we have academics, we have English departments to follow the course of the language. Another piece of it is historical, which is to say that in Great Britain, there is no written constitution, that the law in Britain is dependent upon precedent. That's what we call common law. And in fact, that's the way the English language works. It depends upon precedent. And I think that there's a kind of an elegant cultural harmony between a people who are ruled by tradition and their language, which has developed by tradition and not by rules and not by an academy. And I think it's one of those points upon which the British are so proud to be different from the French. They can draw that line between them. And there's something very rule-bound about French culture in many ways that is expressed also in the existence, the very existence of the French Academy since 1637. I'm looking forward to going and having a tour of the French Academy with a lexicographer in a few months. And I really am very curious about that process. We try to describe the way language is used, and we feel that that's the only honest way to do it. And we feel that very strongly. And if we do it consistently over many, many decades, then that becomes the accumulated wisdom of Merriam-Webster that is projected through the definitions and our usage guidance. And the usage guidance also is dependent upon precedent, evidence, citations, not just taste. I mean, taste is very subjective. We try to find evidence of different usages, and then we will tell you, for example, at an entry for a word like irregardless, we will tell you, if you use this word, you will be judged critically and severely. And so we say, right in the dictionary, use regardless instead. That's advice. That's not a factual piece of information. That's simply usage advice.
Well, I guess the word is extraordinary. It has been extraordinary to have you here in the show. This is In Contrast. My guest was Peter Sokolowski of Merriam-Webster. Thank you for coming.
It's always great to see you. Thank you.
I have a large collection of dictionaries in my personal library. The OED is at the center, and around it are all sorts of volumes. Bilingual dictionaries, dictionaries of slang, regional dictionaries, a dictionary of Shakespeare's English, and so on. My first language isn't English. In fact, it is my fourth. I was born into Spanish, although I also spoke Yiddish as a child, and then came Hebrew. Languages are not only accumulations of words, they are also the way we comprehend the world. I'm a different person when I speak Spanish than when I speak English. Thinking about how many words there are in a language can be dizzying. Merriam-Webster's third edition, Unabridged, together with its 1993 addenda, includes about 500,000 words. It's an enormous amount. It is almost impossible to know all of them, let alone use them on a regular basis. Yet they are there, at our disposal. That's because language is a data bank. In words are the memories of the generations that came before us and the memories that we will give the generations that come after us. Because of this, opening a dictionary may at times feel daunting, but dictionaries are human. What I mean is that they are made by humans. The words they contain are there for us to use, and we also create new ones. We do that all the time because language is in constant motion. It changes as we change. The words I'm using now are transient. Shakespeare would only have understood about half of them. He invented about 1,700 because he felt he needed to. We should too. Let's revere the words that come to us and feel free to create new ones. That is what makes us human. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send us an email at radio@nepr.net. You can also find information about all of NEPR's podcasts at nepr.net or on Apple Podcasts. Next time, a living theater.
If you start from culture and creativity and identity, then anything is possible.
Next time on In Contrast. The executive producer is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thanks for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio.